V for Vendetta, novelization by Steve Moore, continued.
Disc 5.
Much of the journal had been routine, but it was quite plain that the longer he survived, the more Delia Surridge had become fascinated with this man in Room 5, and the magnetic personality he'd seemed to develop as a result of the experiment, quite apart from his speed of movement. She'd obviously been unable to decide whether he was insane, but had noted down the way that, despite saying little, he'd begun to look at her as if she were some sort of insect. As if she were the object of an experiment that he was carrying out, rather than the other way round. Eventually, his behaviour patterns had totally fascinated her, with their semblance of being underscored by some deranged logic that she couldn't quite understand, but always seemed to be on the verge of being able to. More and more often, the journal referred to her having spent a whole day studying the man in Room 5, to the neglect of her other, more inhuman duties. Perhaps that was why she'd persuaded Prothero to allow him special privileges. Only, of course, after she got the tissue samples and cultures she needed from him for the central part of her work, and it had then become a matter of finding out how long he'd survive after what she'd done to him. But once she'd established that he was no longer likely to be infectious, she'd got the commander's agreement to allow him out of his cell, even to give him a little plot of land for gardening. The man had turned out to have a genius for gardening, and with the food shortages, Prothero had been delighted, but that was mainly because Prothero was taking all the extra vegetables for himself. Perhaps that was also why Prothero had allowed a corner of the garden to be turned over to him for growing roses. Violet Carson roses. And to allow Delia to persuade him that the man in Room 5 should be allowed to put in an order for some gardening supplies. And, reading what those supplies were, Finch was absolutely certain that would have been the one fact Prothero had ensured was erased from the official records, even before it was decided to erase the records wholesale anyway. But Delia had been oblivious to all that. She'd merely been watching in fascination as the man arranged certain quantities of his chemicals and fertilizers in piles and lines on the floor of his cell, almost as if he were constructing some sort of model of the world. Like a tabletop train set, without the tracks and engines, but with all the hills and valleys and houses rendered in different coloured heaps of powder, all kept separate, of course, and in patterns, that she was so busy trying to understand that it never occurred to her what might happen when they were mixed together.
November 6th. It started last night, toward midnight. The first explosions tore open the entire medical section. All that work, all my work, gone.
Of course, that was what the journal concentrated on. Not the explosions, the fires, the people running screaming with their clothes and hair in flame, the panicking guards shooting at everyone and everything, the inmates dying shackled where they were because no one thought of their release before smoke inhalation asphyxiated them. How many died that night? No one knew. No one had counted. Civilian casualties hardly mattered. Not those sort of civilians. But there was the date again. Although the entry was dated the 6th, the events concerned had taken place on the 5th. The 5th of November. And it was obvious that all her work hadn't been lost. The reports had been filed, the knowledge preserved. Whatever it was that Delia Surridge had been working on, and Finch couldn't quite put his finger on that, despite reading the journal with the most careful attention to detail, she'd already succeeded by the time the project and Lark Hill itself was brought to a sudden, fiery end.
"I was trying to understand how it could have happened when I saw him, the man from Room 5. He'd used the things we'd given him to garden with, the chemicals, fertilizers and ammonia, to make the bombs. I saw him in the midst of the flames. He looked at me. Not with eyes, there were no eyes. But I know he was looking at me because I felt it, and, oh, God, what have I done?"
14. Evie Hammond woke with a sense of déjà vu, or so she thought at first, though she soon realized that Gordon Dietrich's guest bedroom, with its sumptuously silken bedsheets and marquetry work wardrobes, cloisonné vases and brocade drapes, now parted to let the sunlight stream through in brilliant golden splendour, was quite outside her experience. Not a sense of seen before, then. Smelled before. Uncertain, or more to the point, not quite believing, she began to get an inkling of just what that aroma was, and tumbled out of bed, dressing hurriedly in the clothes that Gordon had fetched for her late the previous night, ringing up a friend with some tale of a long-neglected niece arriving from Carlisle, with nothing more than the clothes she had on at the time, and then risking the curfew to go and borrow an outfit for her. Such good taste he had, too. Although now, knowing what she did about him, that wasn't quite such a surprise. Mind you, anything would have been better than the little pink party dress she'd arrived in. And a night's sleep having soothed away the nerves of the previous day somewhat, she had to say that she couldn't really have hoped to find a better place of sanctuary. Still, thoughts like that weren't getting that aroma investigated. She slipped on her shoes and headed downstairs. As expected, she found Dietrich in the kitchen, a frying pan in one hand, a spatula in the other. "Bonjour, mademoiselle," he grinned brightly, becoming aware of her standing hesitantly at the door, then pausing as he noticed the confused look on her face.
"What's that you're making?"
she asked, taking a tentative pace forward into the kitchen. "We called it eggs in a basket. My mum used to make them. Sit down." She did, still looking a little bewildered, and he served the eggs onto a plate before her. Just the same meal. Just the same way.
"Is this a dream?"
she asked, more to herself than him, though nothing was going to stop her from picking up the knife and fork and making a start.
"What do you mean?"
Dietrich asked, a little bewildered himself now.
"The first morning I was with him, he made me eggs just like this."
"Really?" he asked, eyebrows rising in genuine surprise.
"I swear,"
she assured him, not wanting to be laughed at over something that seemed both so minor and somehow so important to her.
"That's a pretty strange coincidence," he said thoughtfully, perhaps with slightly exaggerated thoughtfulness. "Although there is an obvious explanation."
"There is?"
"Yes, Evie,"
Dietrich said, trying hard to keep a straight face, but not quite succeeding.
"I am V. At last you know the truth."
Evie could only stare at him uncertainly, not quite sure if he was joking, not even sure, after all she'd been through, if she wanted it to be a joke.
"You're stunned, I know,"
he continued debonairly, finding the straight face harder to keep by the moment.
"You wouldn't think it to look at me, but beneath this wrinkled, well-fed exterior lies a dangerous killing machine with a fetish for Foxian masks. Vive la Révolution!"
"That's not funny, Gordon,"
she told him flatly, upset enough to forget her eggs for a moment.
"I know,"
he said, deflatedly. "I'm useless without a studio audience."
"I've seen people go to jail for less than that,"
she added, trying somehow to get him to take the subject seriously. He leaned back against the kitchen counter and sighed.
"That's the problem, isn't it?"
he said, suddenly looking world-weary.
"V is right. We've been culled into silence."
"V kills people," she said shortly,
not certain she liked the direction the conversation was taking.
"Maybe he does, but that doesn't make him any less right."
"So you think that V is doing the right thing?"
asked Evie, not quite believing that she was hearing this sort of thing coming from a figure she'd always regarded as a pillar of the establishment. But that, of course, was before he'd shown her what he had last night. Now, having to think about the answer to her question himself, Gordon Dietrich sank into a chair. A few seconds passed, during which Evie realized her eggs were getting cold. She hurriedly got back to eating them, wolfing most of them down before he spoke again.
"What I think," he said at length, "is that V is simply giving them the same thing they have been giving us."
"What?"
she asked, now genuinely interested in his reply.
"A reason to be afraid."
As time wore on, and Eric Finch finally managed to get his thoughts into some sort of order, he began to ask himself questions both awkward and unsettling. questions that had deprived him of sleep just as thoroughly as the events surrounding the deaths of Bishop Lilliman and Delia Surridge. Sitting there at his computer, having intentionally arrived before anyone else, including Dominic, he was going through the online archives of the Times, and everything he read only made him more afraid of the thoughts that were running round inside his head. Bad thoughts. About bad people. And not necessarily the ones it was his job to catch. "Terrorists strike with biological weapon," thundered one of the headlines. But that wasn't the only one that interested him. Wasn't the only one this particular search had turned up. Bleary-eyed and almost afraid of the way all this was starting to fall into place in his mind, he began to relive the other horrors that had followed that first shocking report from 14 years ago through the ensuing series of headlines. "St. Mary's virus kills 178, said another, and he recalled that had included Evie Hammond's brother. "Three waters infected," and "tube terror." Then, eloquent in its simplicity, "epidemic," one he remembered being involved in personally. Two of the men under him had been brutally murdered there. "Riot at King's Hospital." And finally, the worst one of all. More of an epitaph than a headline. 8,000 dead. Even so, he knew, that was just the total for that first outbreak. When you added on the death toll from the other attacks, like the one in Northern Ireland, the final count was something far, far worse than that. It was all starting to add up, and the sum total was, quite simply, horrible. Finch was still reading when Dominic arrived and greeted him with a cheery, "Morning, Inspector. You're at it early." This morning Finch found Dominic's youthful energy and enthusiasm depressing, but right then he found anything and everything depressing. "Something wrong?" the young man asked, now with genuine concern as he looked at his boss's pasty face. Jesus, the old man wasn't about to have a heart attack, was he? "You don't look so good, sir." Finch shook his head slightly to dispel any fears Dominic might have about his health. Then he reached down into the lower drawer of his desk and pulled out a small electronic device and flicked it on before he said a single word. Dominic reacted in obvious surprise as he recognized the jammer, specifically designed, he knew, to knock out the ears, bugs, and listening devices. No one was supposed to have one of them. That was the sort of thing they arrested people for. "I want to ask you a question, Dominic," Finch began when he was sure the machine had had time enough to warm up and function. "I don't care if you answer me or not, but—" And now Finch nodded toward the device, making it obvious that this was the reason he'd switched it on. "I just want to say this aloud. But I need to know that the question won't leave this office."
"Yeah, of course, Inspector. But—"
It wasn't a question of Finch trusting him. Yet there still remained the outstanding why. And the why was contained in Dominic's glance toward the machine.
"Because of the terrorist?" Dominic asked.
"No."
"What is it, Chief?"
Dominic felt confused enough now that he wanted to sit down.
"What's going on?"
"The question I want to ask is about St. Mary's," Finch told him in a deadly serious and somehow threateningly quiet tone. "And Three Waters." The names were enough to make Dominic's blood run cold. "The question that's kept me up for the last 24 hours, continued Finch slowly, hesitantly, his own blood flowing sluggish with the enormity of it all, "the question I have to ask is, what if the worst, most horrifying biological attack in this country's history was not the work of religious extremists?"
"What?" said Dominic, aghast.
"I don't understand."
"We know it was. They were caught, they confessed, and they were executed, I know," Finch concluded for him. "And that may be what really happened."
It was certainly the official story, anyway. A band of fundamentalists from the Middle East had got hold of some of the same viral agents that the Americans had been using to win one of their dirty little wars in the same neighborhood, the very same biological weapons that so many British agitators had protested so loudly about until the government had finally been forced to withdraw from the NATO alliance some time before the war. And then, lumping all the Western, Christian countries together under the name of the Great Satan, Those extremists had formed a cell over here and carried out revenge attacks in London, in Ireland, and elsewhere, and that was what Finch, like everyone else, had always believed. Until now. It was only reading through the news reports again this morning that he realized that the virus they'd been using wasn't the same as any of the ones the Americans had been using. Similar, yes, but actually far more powerful. Something the Yanks would probably have given their right arms for, if only they could have used it in the war with China. "But I see this chain of events, these coincidences," Finch picked up his train of thoughts again, "and I have to ask, what if that isn't what happened? What if someone else unleashed that virus? What if someone else killed all those people? Would you want to know who it was?"
"Sure," said Dominic,
still trying to get his head round the idea that what he'd taken for certainty, for gospel truth for so many years, might be a tissue of lies. "Even if it was someone working for this government."
"Jesus,"
gasped Dominic slowly, understanding now why Finch had turned on the debugging device. "That's my question," his boss summed up. "If our government was responsible for what happened at St. Mary's and Three Waters, if our own government was responsible for the death of 18,000 people, would you really want to know?"
"Honestly?"
Dominic asked, trading question for question. Finch nodded.
"I don't know."
15.
The champagne cork popped. The bubbly began to foam. The clink of bottle on glass, once, and then twice. Gordon Dietrich handed one of the glasses to Evie and raised it with a smile. A look of real pleasure, and not the rather forced smile, the mask that she'd grown used to seeing while working with him at Jordan Tower. And in the couple of weeks that she'd been living with him, Evie had discovered that when he took that mask off and became his true self, as he only did in the safety of his own home, there was much to admire about Gordon Dietrich. Even to love, in a platonic sort of way. After all, not only was he gay, he was old enough to be her father. And that was at the heart of it. With him going out to buy her clothes, sharing his meals with her, even reading her favourite stories late at night, she began to feel as if she had a home again, for the first time in more years than she recalled. That was more precious to her than she could possibly express, and he, being part of it, had become precious to her as well. Family. Father figure or not, he was kind and caring. He made no demands, and except when the pressures of work left him tired and depressed, he was very good company indeed. And having her around the house seemed to compensate just a little for all those lonely years he'd had to pass since he too had been driven underground. She couldn't help but notice how his spirits had improved since she'd been with him, and at times his sense of humour got so out of hand she wanted less to treat him like a father than to spank him like a little boy. And in the last few days it had got worse. He seemed to be always going round with a secretive smirk on his face, as if he were planning some wonderful practical joke, some wizard wheeze that he didn't want to tell her about for fear of spoiling the surprise. And that, she had to confess, was starting to get her just a little bit worried. Now they were sitting on the couch in his living room at 8:02 on Wednesday evening, and she still had no idea why he seemed so happy. But the barely suppressed excitement that radiated from him made her rather suspect she was about to find out.
"What's all this about?"
Evie asked, as he reached for the remote and turned on the television, cranking up the volume with an excited grin. "I'm celebrating," Dietrich told her, clinking their glasses together and taking a sip. The bubbles burst headily against his palate, matching and then adding to his sense of euphoria.
"Celebrating what?"
asked Evie, still uncertain. She'd never seen him quite like this before, either in the old days at the office or since she'd been staying here with him, and she really wasn't sure what to make of his present mood. But there was something of the gleeful, mischievous schoolboy who'd just got away with a hilarious prank, something of the wild risk-taking of a man who'd stepped over the line and didn't care who knew it, something that reminded her of her father's revolutionary zeal, and of V's, and something of the innocent, gullible fool.
"This could be the best show we've ever done," he chuckled,
as the familiar theme music swelled, the equally familiar night blue and gold titles for Dietrich's Half Hour appearing, with their futurist-style view of Big Ben, Tower Bridge, and other London landmarks, and in one corner of the screen the BTN logo that made everything official. The hands of Big Ben were set at 8 o'clock, and millions of people across the land would eagerly be tuned in. On the screen, Dietrich appeared from behind the curtains, smiling as he always did, walking out to take the applause of the studio audience. A real studio audience, this one. Not like the fake footage and soundtrack they used to have on Provero's nightly political farce. After all, this was genuine farce, and that was something the authorities considered safe enough to record before a live audience of the happy British public. That always played well. An audience was something Dietrich always played too well besides.
Thank you, and good evening, ladies and gentlemen," the on-screen Dietrich began, again, as always.
The next lines, though, were a little different.
"We've got a really special show tonight. You won't believe it. I'm not sure I do. Would you please give a very warm welcome to our very own Chancellor, Adam Sutler?"
The audience gasped. And so did Evie, looking round toward Dietrich as if she wasn't sure this was really happening. As if she hoped this wasn't really happening.
"We threw out the censor-approved script and shot a new one that I wrote this morning," he explained, eyes sparkling.
"Oh, my God," was all Evie could think to say, turning her attention back toward the set. Surely he wouldn't do something like that, she hoped desperately. That was breaking the one rule that no one at BTN ever broke. When she was at Jordan Tower, she hadn't heard of anyone since before the reclamation who'd dared to do that. But if anyone was going to do it, it had to be Gordon. The only question now was, how bad was it going to get? There was a subtler look-alike stepping out from behind the curtain, just as Dietrich had done a few moments earlier, nodding like Mussolini in appreciation of the audience response as the crowd went wild. And then the camera panned away from the Chancellor, out across the cheering audience, before lingering on several heavily armed and, for the most part, heavily overweight and decidedly scruffy-looking soldiers who were aiming their guns at the happy-clapping mob, trigger fingers poised while standing beneath a large, lit-up applause sign.
"Christ, Gordon!"
spluttered Evie, almost spitting champagne out through her nose. Even so, she knew that after an opening like that it was only going to get worse. And it did. Back on the TV screen, two beautiful showgirls were leading Sutler, who seemed unable to stop himself from saluting and goose-stepping in time to the military march struck up by the studio orchestra, toward a typical chat show arrangement of comfortable chairs where Dietrich was waiting for him. They shook hands as the music died, Dietrich giving a slightly mocking, overly deferential bow, and sat down. And when they made themselves comfortable, the host began.
"I understand, Chancellor," Dietrich smiled unctuously, "that you've been under tremendous stress since this whole terrorist business began, and so we thought we might help you try to relax."
A glance round then, a beckoning hand raised toward the background.
"Girls?"
A gaggle of giggling showgirls materialized at Dietrich's command, all feathers, smiles, and high heels, gushing excitement as they tottered toward the Chancellor. One of them carried a small tray on which was placed a glass of milk.
"Oh, warm milk!" exclaimed the Sutler clone foguishly, displaying a sort of second childhood delight. "There's nothing better!"
"You enjoy a glass every night, don't you, Chancellor?" Dietrich said knowingly, everything about his tone and body language suggesting he was humouring a senile old fool.
"Since I was a boy," his foil replied, with smug delight, taking a sip and smacking his lips before relaxing theatrically, as a couple of the more voluptuous showgirls began massaging his shoulders enthusiastically, leaning forward to display their considerable assets to best advantage.
And the Chancellor rolled his eyes exaggeratedly to enjoy the view.
"But you're wrong, Mr. Dietrich," he said eventually, apparently making a strenuous effort to get his mind back on the subject at hand. "The terrorist was never a serious concern."
Evie could only watch, in growing horror, as the camera drew back to show a trap door opening in the studio floor next to Sutler's chair. A tall, black Jacobean hat began to appear, then a mask, and up popped V, caped as usual, raising a hand toward the mask as if to twiddle his mustache in the style of a vaudeville villain. Then, crawling between the legs of the showgirls, who looked down at him with expressions of pop-eyed surprise and lips puckered into silent, comical oohs, V sneaked over and, apparently unnoticed by either Dietrich or his victim, began to secretly tie the Chancellor's shoelaces together. All across the land, Evie knew, the same audience who'd watched V's original broadcast would now be watching these satirical antics that, in many ways, were just as damaging to the powers that be. She couldn't imagine what Dietrich thought he was doing, or where he'd got the idea. Until she remembered God Save the Queen, securely hidden down there in the basement.
"So is the terrorist still alive and active?" Dietrich continued blithely, glancing round toward his showgirls, cueing one of them to produce a large cigar.
She prepared to light it, only to have it taken away from her by V, who substituted another in its place.
"The terrorist has been neutralized," said Sutler, with a smile of absolute confidence, taking the ready-lit cigar and starting to puff.
And Evie knew exactly what was going to happen next. It was going to be one of those Bugs Bunny cartoon moments. And of course it was. The cigar exploded with a large bang and a thick puff of smoke, and then, while the audience broke into screaming peals of laughter, some under-costume tubing appeared to send steam shooting out of the raging Chancellor's ears. As the gale of laughter and applause finally subsided, Dietrich looked round toward the showgirls and seemed to notice for the first time V hiding among them.
"Oh my God, Chancellor!" he exclaimed in surprise, pointing with a finger that shot out just past the Chancellor's nose. "Look! That terrorist!" cried Sutler, leaping to his feet and immediately pratfalling forward on his face as the knotted laces between his feet pulled tight. "Get him!" the Chancellor commanded next, rolling to a sitting position and starting to untie his shoes.
And the soldiers who'd been seen earlier dashed forward and began chasing V round the stage, accompanied by the tittering, tottering showgirls. Then the whole crew scampered out into the audience and back to the stage again, while the orchestra played an exaggeratedly speeded-up accompaniment, and the audience went wild with laughter. And all through this madcap chase, reminiscent of the closing scenes of an ancient Benny Hill show, Gordon Dietrich sat benignly in his chair, obviously enjoying his finest moment ever on the air, impeccable and impervious to the chaos all around him. And Evie could only stare in horrified shock, almost unaware that Dietrich was sitting there beside her, enjoying the experience, the glory, all over again. At last the soldiers, one or two of whom had managed to capture showgirls by mistake, finally caught V and wrestled him to the ground. And now Sutler, on his feet and all his freedom of movement fully restored, stepped forward and reached toward V's mask.
"At last!" he cried. "And now, for all the world to see!"
But as the mask was ripped away, another surprise was revealed, stunning both soldiers and audience alike. For the terrorist turned out to be another Sutler look-alike, and as the soldiers looked on with their mouths hanging open comically, he leapt to his feet, tossed aside the hat, cloak, and wig, and revealed himself wearing exactly the same suit as the first impersonator.
"Unhand me!" he cried. "I'm your Chancellor!"
"What?" the first Sutler exploded.
"How dare you! I'm the Chancellor!"
"Imposter!"
came the pantomime response, and then they lunged at each other, going down in a tumbling ball of flailing fists and thrashing legs, until, wound together like a Möbius strip, it became quite impossible to tell one Chancellor from the other. All it really needed to complete the humiliating farce was for their pants to fall down, revealing red and white polka-dot boxer shorts. But it seemed even Gordon hadn't dared to go that far. Or perhaps he just hadn't thought of it. Finally, they broke apart and leapt to their feet, pointing furiously at each other, and one cried,
"Soldiers, that man is the terrorist!"
And the other screamed,
"I order you to shoot that traitor! That liar! That fake! That fraud! Ready! Aim! Fire!"
a staccato rattle of automatic weaponry as the soldiers opened fire, and then the two sutlers slapped concealed blood capsules against their chests and spun to the ground, the curtain crashing down just after they hit the deck. And the audience went wild, in a way that no one could quite have anticipated. Certainly not the man who sat watching his TV set with a glass of warm milk gripped rigidly in one hand, staring as Dietrich made a profound, theatrical bow and disappeared behind the curtain. Was still staring when the masked, smiling face of V appeared through the slit in the curtain a moment later, grin seeming wider than ever, and twisted his moustaches once again, and the audience cheered. Cheered. And the glass of milk shattered in the aging man's hand. Evie was still watching, in a similar shock that was now rapidly turning to stone-cold fear, though not clutching her champagne glass quite so hard, when the phone rang. Dietrich, still chuckling to himself, put down his own glass and went to answer it. He listened for a while, but seemed quite impervious to the message he was getting from the other end of the line. "What are they going to do?" he asked, still buoyed up with his triumph. "Fine us? Big deal. We have the most watched show on the air." A pause, and then, "Well, you're a lawyer. That's what I pay you for. Protect me!" And with that he hung up. "I should have hired him years ago to be my mother," he said, smiling as he turned back to Evie. "You're mad," she told him bluntly, still not quite believing what she'd just seen. "Either that or I wasn't breastfed," he quipped. "Is everything a joke to you?" "Only the things that matter." Though he looked a little more serious as he said that, it was obvious that she just wasn't able to get through to him. Right at the moment, probably no one could.
"Gordon, what if they come after you?"
she asked, finally managing to express the dread she felt. Not just for him, but for both of them. "Look," he said reassuringly, sitting down and taking her hand, "I'll tell you what's going to happen. I'll have to make some kind of apology and do some boring fundraiser, and in the meantime our ratings will go through the roof. Trust me, it'll be fine." She tried to nod, tried to smile, but it was quite obvious to both of them that she wasn't convinced. As the hours passed and the stars wheeled away the time, the gilded moon drew a veil of cloud across her face, almost as if she no longer had the stomach to watch events in the world of men below, and the night became very dark indeed. The sound of breaking glass woke Evie. That icy tinkle that froze the heart and shattered the silence, her dreams and her world. It was followed by a loud thump, and movement started once again. The movement of people down in the house below, the thunderous pumping of her heart.
"Gordon?"
she queried desperately, sitting up in bed, overwhelmed by the feeling that she'd been through all this before. But it shouldn't be happening all over again. Surely it couldn't be happening again. It was. And the dreadful fear that she'd almost managed to forget since she'd arrived in Bloomsbury, that was back again too. A gunshot echoed through the house, and then there was the sound of heavy footsteps on the stairs, stumbling as they reached the landing, pounding toward her. And then Gordon Dietrich burst into her room, slamming the door behind him, wearing only a robe and lathered in sweat, gasping for breath, the whites of his eyes bright in the darkness. All happening again.
"Hide, Evie!"
he managed to choke out quickly, throwing his considerable bulk back against the door.
"Quick!"
For a moment, Evie just wanted to burst into tears, to shut her eyes and make it all go away when she opened them again, to be a little girl once more, wrapped up in the love of her mummy and daddy, surrounded by the toys that she loved in her turn, with Teddy, to hug him close and say the magic word that set the world aright. But there was no magic word, and nothing would set this right now. Panic took over then. And she rolled out of the bed, hit the floor hard, and scrambled into the shadows beneath the bedstead. Lay there quaking with terror, remembering how she'd done exactly the same thing before, and all the terrible things that had followed. Repetitions and coincidences. as if God only had a limited number of stories to tell per individual person, and just wanted to replay them over and over, making his cast jump through the same hoops time after time, until they finally collapsed with exhaustion, or until, perhaps, they'd learned the lesson they needed to and managed to escape the play into the world of greater freedom outside the theatre. Only instant later the door exploded from its hinges, throwing Dietrich aside like a limp sack. As he staggered, trying to regain his balance, a swarm of heavily armed, dark-clad paramilitary fingermen flooded into the room. "What do you think?" he managed to get out, but a rifle butt smashed into his mouth and cut the question short. Beneath the bed, Evie could see only Dietrich's bare feet, seeming pale and old and venous against the polished black leather boots, and think how terribly vulnerable they looked as the fingermen took their prisoner in hand. Then Peter Creedy was there, gloating, his favourite, well-used truncheon in his hand. It flailed down with a sick thud, then landed again with much more of a bony crack.
"Not so funny now, is it, funny man?" he grunted, as Dietrich sobbed and gurgled for breath.
Another hit, and then the most famous television face in the land, now that Lewis Prothero was gone, hit the floor hard, and looked toward the fugitive under the bed. And both of them knew that that face, now split open like the skin of a watermelon to reveal the red pulp within, would never be seen on television again. He tried to say something, to beg them to stop the kicking they were continuing to give him even as they zip-tied his hands behind his back, but his jaw was broken, and all he could manage was a gurgling scream. He writhed, looked away, looked back. His eyes searched for Evie, locked with her own. All happening again. She could only stare back helplessly, remembering the way it had happened to her parents, and how her mother had looked at her just like that, feeling the panic attack clutching at her throat, starting to hyperventilate. All happening again, trying not to scream as they yanked the shiny black bag over his head and pulled it tight round his neck like a noose. All happening again. 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 And Evie Hammond, still sick with terror, suddenly found her whole self filling up with a burning, angry hate for Peter Creedy and his fingermen, and their arrogant, vicious, and appallingly casual brutality, for Adam Sutler and his party who gave the finger their orders, and who had turned this country into a hell in the name of making it a heaven, to a lesser extent for Gordon Dietrich, for being so wonderfully, stupidly heroic in launching his satirical attack on the evils of the world, and never being wise enough to realize the dire consequences that his foolhardy actions would bring, but most of all, for herself. For she felt responsible for all that had happened, for giving him someone to show off his bravery to, for being here in the first place and landing him with someone to protect, for not having the same sort of courage that he'd had in standing up against them, and still, no matter what she might think of what he was doing, she hated herself for betraying V's trust. Most of all, she hated the fear she'd always felt, which had never let her live the life she wanted to live, and held her paralyzed and quaking beneath the bed even now, despite the self-loathing it provoked. Then they hauled Gordon Dietrich to his feet, his old, bare feet now spattered with dripping blood, and dragged him out the door, laughing as they did so. And there was nothing she could do to help him. Nothing anyone could do now. Sound receded from the house then, like the ebbing of the tide. The footsteps going down the stairs, the slamming of the front door, the sound of engines starting outside and driving off down the street. And when silence finally had the place securely in its grasp, Evie pushed her way out from under the bed, knowing she dare not stay, for, after the first raid, others would undoubtedly come to search the place more thoroughly, not for proof against Dietrich, after the evening's television show no other proof was needed for what was going to happen to him now, but for evidence of accomplices, of fellow conspirators plotting together to satirize and overthrow the state, perhaps even, if their surveillance was good, for her. If, indeed, everyone had left the house, she thought, dressing hurriedly and silently. For all she knew, fingermen might be lurking there still, just waiting for anyone who, thinking silence meant safety, might now emerge from a hiding place and, seeking to escape, fall into their hands like ripe fruit dropping from a tree. Not the front door, then. Instead, she climbed out the open bedroom window and crawled out onto a small roof beyond. The roof overlooked the back garden behind the house, and she slid down to its edge, grabbing the guttering before she fell right off. Even so, when she peered over, the ground still looked too far away to risk a jump. She threw one leg over the edge of the roof, then the other, scrambling for a handhold that would stop her sliding, and managed to ease her body over the edge. She hoped desperately that the gutter would take her weight as she grabbed it hurriedly, feeling herself slipping out of control, going down quickly, catching her jaw a glancing blow on the gutter edge, then falling until she felt her arms snap out straight. She winced with pain at the pull on suddenly stretched joints and shoulders, then felt the gutter pull out of its brackets, and she was falling, trying desperately in that instant to remember whether it was better to keep her legs straight or bent, and deciding on the latter. Then hitting the ground with a soft thump, thankful that she'd remembered right, but sprawling heavily on a concrete patio nonetheless. She stayed low as a flashlight shone out from inside the house, swung across the garden, and then turned back inside. Lights and shadows moved around eerily within, all the more threatening for the accompanying silence. Obviously, they were still searching, waiting for some betraying sound or movement. And as Dietrich had been known to live alone, she realized that meant they were looking for her. Taking a deep breath and trying to calm herself, she began to wriggle away across the patio on her belly, made it to a bed of shrubbery, and began to crawl through it toward the garden gate. No thought of how dirty her clothes must be getting, of how the branches were pulling at her hair, not even of where she might go from here. Escape was the only thing she had on her mind at that moment, and if she had to keep running until she'd left the country entirely, then somehow she would. A few moments later, she was through the gate and out into the back alley, finally starting to breathe properly for the first time since she'd heard the sound of breaking glass. Now, then. Away. Anywhere away from here, though she still had no idea of a destination at all. Perhaps the best idea was to try to get out of London, even out of the quarantined safe zones the government had established. She'd never been entirely sure what lay beyond them. The TV news kept reporting outbreaks of plague and other horrors, but she no longer believed the media anyway. But if they were beyond the areas where the government writ normally ran, they might be her last best hope. And right now even the risk of disease seemed better than the prospect of the black bag. Mind made up, and starting to feel better simply for having a sense of purpose, she looked up the alley, took a deep breath, and set off. But no sooner had she started to move than a hand landed on her shoulder, jerking her backward and grabbing her arms with a force that made her sudden, desperate struggles absolutely useless. "Gotcha!" said a rough, masculine voice behind her, and though she tried to look back over her shoulder as she felt the plastic zip ties tighten round her wrists, she could only see a dark, faceless figure in the deeper darkness of the night. But if she couldn't see who, she certainly knew what. A finger man.
"No!"
she squealed frantically, shaking helplessly in horrified, bowel-loosening fear.
"No! Please!"
But plead, shriek, or fight as she might, there was no escape. Nothing that could be done to stop the black plastic bag from being drawn over her head, being tightened round her neck, and drowning out her piercing scream of absolute, abject terror. 16. When they pulled the black bag off, Evie had lost all track of time. She remembered being roughly dragged along, half-fainting, and thrust into a truck, remembered the noise of its engine, the raucous chatter of the guards, and even their very breathing, the smell of them, and the odour of her own fear, surprised despite her terror at how swiftly, when the sense of sight was removed, the other senses had become heightened. And the one thing that she did have to be thankful for was that she hadn't been sick inside the bag. Although, with the way she thought of herself now, that humiliation would have seemed like a deserved punishment. For it seemed to her it was fear that had brought all this on her, and whatever happened to her from now on she had only herself to blame. She was sure she'd passed out at some point, but whether that was before or after they'd buffeted her out of the truck, dragged her down some stairs and shoved her along a corridor, she couldn't tell. The sound of a shutting door and the grating of its lock was clear enough, and she remembered how they'd merely dumped her on a stone-cold floor without food, without water, without toilet facilities. And so she'd had no alternative, eventually, but just to let go on the floor. And somehow that seemed a small revenge in itself. How long had passed after that before a guard came to collect her, she had no idea. He called her a dirty little cow, but he'd finally freed her sore, chafed wrists from the zip-ties and dragged her here, somewhere, and sat her down roughly in a chair. And then they did, at last, remove the hood. She so wanted to look, to see where she was, just to use her eyes again, but the lights that shone in her face were so brilliant, and her pupils were so distended from the long darkness that she had no alternative but to shut them again. But in that instant she'd managed to see a desk before her, and the dark shape of a man sitting opposite, behind the lights that shone full in her face. "Do you know why you are here, Evie Hammond?" he said coldly, and blinking and squinting she tried to open her eyes again, only to see nothing but red shapes that flared upon her retina, and an unmoving shadow to whom she addressed a simple, "Please." She tried to look round her then, but as she did so a hand cuffed round the back of her head from behind, making it quite clear that she was to keep her attention on the interrogator before her, and nowhere else. But in the instant she'd been able to see, she'd taken in a bare room, windowless, and with nothing to break the monotony of the blank walls but a "strength through unity, unity through faith" poster. "You are being formally charged with 3 counts of murder," the interrogator continued matter-of-factly, though not without a hint of malice. "The bombing of government property and conspiracy to commit acts of terrorism, treason, and sedition, the penalty for which is death by firing squad." Evie felt as if every word were a punch in the stomach. This was everything she'd dreaded, and every bit as bad as it could get, all laid out in the plainest terms. The only relief was that they hadn't put a bullet through her brain already, as she rather suspected they would have done with Gordon Dietrich. That they hadn't must mean that there was some reason for keeping her alive, something they wanted from her. She opened her mouth then, but nothing came out. "You have one chance and only one chance to save your life," the interrogator continued, and now she detected a trace of eagerness in his voice. Strange the way her hearing seemed to have become almost supernaturally heightened in the few hours she'd been forced to rely on it most of all. Not just sensitive to the slightest whisper, but a nuance and tone beside. "You must tell us the identity or whereabouts of code name V," the voice said next. "If the information leads to his capture, you will be immediately released from this facility. Do you understand what I'm telling you?" There it was. The deal she'd wanted to make when she'd almost betrayed V to the bishop, the last, best hope she'd clung to all along. Until, when was it? Last night? Until they'd come along and done what they'd done to Gordon Dietrich. Poor old foolish, brave Gordon Dietrich. "You can return to your normal life, Miss Hammond," the man emphasized, seeming, to her watering eyes, to lean forward until he was almost, but not quite, visible in the light. "All you have to do is cooperate." Cooperate. And go free. If she could believe them. If they didn't shoot her as soon as she'd told them everything she knew. "I—" Evie began hesitantly, hesitated some more, and sucked in a breath. "I don't know." "Process her, Rossiter," the man said shortly, disappointment adding venom to the words. And while she was still looking round, dazzled to see whom the command had been addressed to, rough hands grabbed her from behind, bagged her head again, and once more dragged her away. She wept when they shaved her head. She didn't mean to, didn't want to, but her hair was the one thing about her appearance that she'd always been proud of, always thought her best feature. And as the rough hand ran the crude, hurtful electric clippers over her scalp, As the long blonde tresses rained down on the floor, she felt that this, more than anything, was stripping away the sense of identity that she'd clung to for years. With this, she was no longer Evie Hammond. She was just a prisoner, without even a number, a cipher, a subject, nobody. A nobody who was very, very afraid. But then they'd known the head shaving would make her feel like this, which was why they'd done it in the first place. There might be physical torture later, but first there would be humiliation. They stripped her clothes away next, took her naked into a room and manacled her wrists to a ceiling hook, then left her dangling while they hosed her down with powerful jets of water that buffeted her, left her breathless, bruised her, and eventually became more a form of torture than the washing and delousing it pretended to be. And then, while her skin was still raw and pink and hurting, they pulled a rough hemp dress down over her head, more like a penitent's hair shirt than anything else, refused her any shoes or underwear, and dragged her away to a cell. A cell with one small window, too high up to see out of, and an electric socket in the ceiling without a light bulb, so when the day ended there was only darkness. A grill in the door looked out into a dank corridor with, directly opposite, another of those strength through unity, unity through faith posters, whose message she'd long ago ceased to believe in. She had no faith, and fearfully little strength, and she now realized unity for this government meant little more than murdering anyone who disagreed with anything it said. There was a bare shelf to sleep on, without any bedding, and a bucket that served as a toilet which no one bothered to empty until it was full, and a rat hole down by the floor where the only other inhabitant of the cell emerged after dark to run over her body in the night, to eat her dress while she slept, to bite her while she lay there stupefied with terror. And then they offered her food. One look was enough to make her want to vomit, because vomit was exactly what the food they offered looked like. Even the rat wouldn't touch it. Why didn't they just kill her straight away? She was sure they were going to, regardless of whether she cooperated, so why not do the merciful thing and kill her now? But mercy wasn't on their agenda, of course, and besides, she desperately wanted to live. Her sense of time began to blur again. The minutes passed, somehow, but with only 4 stone walls to look at and that increasingly stupid poster, there was nothing to divert her attention. At any hour of the day or night, they'd drag her away for further questioning, for beatings, torture, and humiliation. They showed her surveillance camera footage from the alley where first she'd met V, accused her of being a plant, sent in by the terrorist to distract the fingermen before he moved in to kill and maim them. When she denied it, they questioned her furiously about what he'd said to her afterward, then pointed out how obvious it was that she'd willingly left the scene with him, showed her more footage taken near the Old Bailey and at Westminster, demanding to know how she explained her presence there. And more than that, how did she account for her ID being used at Lewis Protheroe's apartment building? Told her, too, that the young priest at the deanery had positively identified her as V's accomplice in the murder of the bishop, and how did she explain that? And what was the terrorist going to do next? Endless, endless questions. And when she couldn't or wouldn't answer, and even her interrogator was becoming exasperated, the man Rossiter would drench her with buckets of water and take her back, cold and shivering, to her cell. She slept whenever she could, unconsciousness being her only escape. But always it seemed to her that as soon as she fell asleep, a loudspeaker would boom into life, and a military band would play Sutler's recently written national anthem over and over, sometimes for hours on end, until she couldn't stand it any more. And then they'd thrash her with thin bamboo canes until her skin was raw, and even if she wanted to sleep she couldn't possibly lie down. That was the part Rossiter seemed to enjoy the most. The beatings, the cigarette burns, the humiliation. An evil, sadistic thug, he was everything she'd expected a fingerman torturer to be, and the only surprise to her was that he stopped short of inflicting permanent physical damage. But with everything else added to the random acts of violence, the sleep deprivation, the interrogation, the miserable state of her cell, the mental damage being caused was quite enough. Eventually, so disoriented she thought it was night when the light shone through the window and day when it was dark, she began to eat the food. That made her cry in itself, that she'd reached that point of degradation where she'd eat that filth. But crying was what she did most of the time anyway, when they gave her a minute to herself. And the rat came and went, providing the only entertainment she had, the only companionship, love bites in the dark. And when the rat's attentions were all she had left to look forward to, she realized there really wasn't any lower to go. No better than a rat. Probably worse. And then the rat didn't come any more either, and her loneliness was absolutely complete. And the light shone through the window sometimes, and sometimes it didn't, and the questioning never stopped. Eventually, in one of those periods of total silence that somehow had become even more difficult to sleep in than the periods of continual noise, she heard a faint scratching sound from the hole down at the foot of the wall. Thinking joyfully that her rat had at last returned, she uncoiled slowly from the fetal ball in which she'd been trying to sleep, painfully eased her emaciated body off the bed shelf, and crawled across the floor. There was no rat. But something else was in the hole, something that had been pushed through from the other side. A small roll of toilet paper. Evie looked at it in astonishment. Toilet paper was something she hadn't seen since she was arrested. Something she'd almost forgotten existed. Even more astonishing was that this little roll of paper had writing on it. Crude, and in pencil, it looked like the sort of script she'd expect to write herself after weeks of torture and starvation. It could only be, she thought, a message from the prisoner in the cell next door. Unless this was just another malicious fraud on the part of her interrogators. Either way, it gave her something to do, something to read. A voice from somewhere outside her own personal hell. And if anything could fill up even a minute of the long, lonely hours, she'd gratefully accept it, no matter where it came from. Just so long as it didn't mention V, or ask her to explain anything. Dragging herself over into the light from the window and propping herself up against the wall, she began to unroll the fragile missive.
I know there is no way I can convince you that this is not one of their tricks, but I don't care. I am me. My name is Valerie. I don't think I will live much longer, and I wanted to tell someone about my life. I'm writing this with a pencil that I hid inside of me. This is the only autobiography that I will ever write, and, oh God, I'm writing it on toilet paper.
Another woman. And that seemed important to Evie. Even if it turned out that they had entirely different backgrounds. They still had that basic something in common, the shared gender, the sense of being women together in trouble, of being sisters under the skin, as the old cliché had it. Avidly she read on.
I was born in Nottingham. I don't remember much about my early years, but I do remember the rain. My grandmother owned a farm in Tottlebrook, and she used to tell me that God was in the rain. The sound of rain tapping on a window has always felt like home. I passed my 11+, and went to girls' grammar.
Secondary school. Something Evie had never known, having spent most of her teenage years after the arrest of her parents in the Juvenile Reclamation Project, a hellish young offenders institution over in Wapping, and that had featured an educational curriculum of an entirely different sort, fear, brutality, abuse, and the Bible. Followed by the rote slogan learning they called political re-education. Strength through unity, unity through faith. England prevails. The different are the damned, and on, and on, and on. And the pointless marching, and hold your arm out straighter when you're saluting, girl! Beatings for the slightest misdemeanour, and as soon as it looked as if you might be making a friend, they maliciously split you apart somehow, sent your chum to another wing, another prison, another world.
Grammar school. School friends. Teenage romance. What on earth could it have been like? It was at school that I met my first girlfriend. Her name was Sarah. It was her wrists. They were beautiful. I thought we would love each other forever. I remember our teacher telling us that it was an adolescent phase that people grew out of. Sarah did. I didn't.
So simply said, but so much pain disguised. Evie began to weep again, knowing that under any normal circumstances she wouldn't, but her nerves were so frayed, her emotions so near the surface, it was just impossible not to. Eventually, sniffing and trying to pull herself together, she had no handkerchief on which to blow her nose, and that thought made her weep again to think so suddenly of her mother. She read on through her tears.
Later I fell in love with a girl called Christina. That was when I came out to my parents. I'm not sure I could have done it without Chris holding my hand. My father wouldn't look at me. He told me to go and never come back. My mother said nothing. But I'd only told them the truth. Was that so selfish? Our integrity sells for so little, but it is all we really have. It is the very last inch of us. But within that inch, we are free.
Evie heard them coming for her again then. In sudden panic, knowing full well they'd take the message away from her if they found it, she managed to wriggle across the floor and stuff it back into the rat hole. She couldn't let them have it. Not now. When she'd just discovered a lifeline, a contact with something outside her own personal hell. A magic word that opened up another world. Rossiter, the guard, came and black-bagged her head again, as they always seemed to do when moving her round her prison, then manacled her hands behind her and took her into the usual interrogation room, and stood her over a table on which, she saw when the hood was removed, was placed a large, full bowl of water. He looked over toward the usual interrogator, briefly, asked her yet again about V, and when she yet again had nothing to say, pushed her face down into the water and held her down for what seemed like hours. She came up, spluttering and choking, and almost before she'd had time to gasp in another breath, her head was thrust down below the surface again. "It ends whenever you want it to," the interrogator told her from behind the lights, when she was eventually pulled up again. She merely looked at him, dead-eyed. Down into the water again, this time held under, it seemed, to within an inch of her life. And Valerie's words came back to her then.
"It is the very last inch of us. But within that inch, we are free."
"Just tell us where he is," she was asked again. Integrity, she thought. The very last inch.
"I don't know," she told him.
Eventually, when they were as tired of hearing the same answer as she was of giving it, and when it seemed that just one more semi-drowning would make her heart give out, they dragged her limp body back to the filthy, mephitic cell. It seemed like hours before she felt strong enough to roll across the floor and pluck out the roll that had already become an almost sacred text to her.
"I moved to London. I'd never been so happy. I'd always known what I wanted to do with my life. A couple of years later I starred in my first film, The Salt Flats. It was the most important role in my life, not because of my career, but because that was how I met Ruth. The first time we kissed, I knew that I never wanted to kiss any other's lips again but hers. We moved into a small flat in London together. She grew violet carsons on the balcony for me, and our kitchen always smelled of roses. Those were the best years of my life. But America's war grew worse and worse, and eventually the same sort of hell came to London. After that, there were no roses any more. Not for anyone."
Surprisingly quickly, Rossiter came for her again, stuck her head in the black bag she'd used to dread so much but was now past caring about, shackled her hands behind her, and simply left her lying on the floor. Total silence fell after he'd left and locked the door, and she could only lie there in sensory deprivation and total uncertainty for an unknown time that seemed to last forever. Leaving her alone to think, but probably not of the subjects they wanted her to think about. Of Valerie, and the world's curious parallels and repetitions. An actress, just as Evie had always wanted to be, until the world had gone to hell, the world in general, and her personal world. After all, whatever other things one might learn in a juvenile reclamation project, lying, cheating, stealing and fighting, to name only a few, acting certainly wasn't one. But if Evie could envy Valerie that brief joy, there was nothing to be envied in the way that she too had ended up in this prison hell. And all, it seemed, for love. For loving too well, too honestly, too bravely. Eventually the hood was removed, the shackles too, and then the guard was leaning down to shout in her face.
"You won't last much longer. You're going to die here. Why protect someone who doesn't give a shit about you?"
She stared at him blank-eyed, hardly knowing the answer to that question herself. Except that was what they wanted from her, and she wasn't going to give it to them. So when he'd gone, and when she felt strong enough, she began to read once again, to read an unfamiliar person's viewpoint on familiar things. No, that wasn't true. Valerie wasn't unfamiliar to her now. Unless they'd taken her away as soon as she'd forced the message through the hole, Valerie was sitting in the cell next door. Valerie was her companion in adversity, her friend, her only friend, the last one she had in the world. Unless she was already dead. Dead. What did that mean? Weren't they all dead in here? Weren't they, perhaps, with one single exception, all dead in the England of today? Hadn't they been for years, and wasn't that why they were in the situation they found themselves in today? How long ago had the nation become a corpse, and how had it happened?
I remember how the meaning of words began to change, how unfamiliar words like collateral damage and extraordinary rendition became frightening, while things like Norse fire and articles of allegiance became so powerful. And I remember how different became dangerous. I still don't understand it. Why do they hate us so much? They took Ruth while she was out looking for food. I've never cried so hard in my life. It wasn't long until they came for me.
And Evie could only cry again in turn, knowing exactly what must have happened. Ruth must have cracked under torture, or even just the threat of it. Told them everything. The relationship. Valerie's name. The address. All exchanged for a life that, Evie knew, wouldn't have been worth living afterward. The sort of life that ends in suicide.
"They called me a criminal, and told me my films would be burned. They shaved my hair. They held my head down a toilet and molested me. They've injected me with chemicals. My skin is covered in purple bruises, and I can't feel my tongue anymore. It seems strange that my life should end in such a terrible place. But for 3 years I had roses and apologized to no one. I shall die here. Every inch of me shall perish. Every inch but one. An inch. It's small and fragile, and it's the only thing in the world worth having. We must never lose it or give it away. We must never let them take it away from us. I hope that, whoever you are, you escape this place. I hope that the world turns and that things get better. But what I hope most of all is that you understand what I mean when I tell you that, even though I do not know you, and even though I may never meet you, laugh with you, cry with you, or kiss you, I love you. With all my heart, I love you. Valerie."
And, still sobbing, Evie could do nothing else but kiss that signature, that testament on toilet paper. And doing so, she kissed the world entire. She knew when they next bagged her and took her away, whether it was from intuition or some subtle difference in Rossiter's attitude, that she was fast approaching the end. And when the hood was removed, and she sat there blinking in the interrogation lights, the end was there indeed. "I have been told to inform you," the man behind the desk began, "that you have been convicted by a special tribunal, and that unless you are ready to offer your cooperation, you are to be executed. Do you understand what I am telling you?"
"Yes,"
she said softly, staring at the silhouetted head, trying to look the man straight in the eye. "Are you ready to cooperate?"
"No."
And in the silence that followed, the tiniest hint of a smile passed across her lips.
"Very well," the man said in a voice that mingled weary exasperation and puzzled incomprehension, and then continued to Rossiter, unseen behind her. "Escort Miss Hammond back to her cell. Arrange a detail of 6 men. Then take her out behind the chemical sheds and shoot her." If they expected any reaction to that, they didn't get it. The black bag was placed over her head one last time, and just for a moment the thought ran through her head that she wouldn't have to put up with that any more. But then, she wouldn't actually have to put up with anything ever again. Evie was still holding Valerie's letter when Rossiter came for the final time. She had thought to take it with her to her death, one last sentimental gesture, a treasure to take with her to the grave. But why? Ultimately, you couldn't take anything with you. Not anything physical, anyway. Only the one small thing she'd come to treasure most of all. Integrity. Instead, she placed the letter reverently on the bedshelf and stood up, and remembered suddenly a tale told to her by her father long ago that she'd never quite understood at the time, of how a Tibetan Buddhist monk, escaping the Chinese soldiers swarming through his country, had almost crossed the Himalayas to safety when he was told that his entire family, left behind after being given assurances of safety, had just been killed. And while his companions could only receive the news with horror, all the monk could do was laugh. And how, asked about the incident in later years, he had said that that was the nearest he had ever come to enlightenment. For everything was gone then, and there was nothing left but release.
"It's time," said Rossiter, staring at her from the open doorway.
"I'm ready," she said, getting to her feet with an almost beatific smile.
"All they want is one little piece of information," he said, showing the slightest touch of human warmth, something that he'd never shown before, as if, in the end, he wanted her to survive after all, despite everything. As if he couldn't understand why she wouldn't give in, when he most surely would. Just give them something. Anything.
"Thank you," she said,
an almost mischievous sparkle in her eye.
"But I'd rather die behind the chemical sheds."
"Then you have no fear any more," he said, trying to suppress a smile. "You are completely free." And he turned and left. Left the cell door standing open, too. Evie, completely taken aback, could only stand and stare. And eventually, listening to the footsteps receding down the corridor, choke out a single word.
"What?"
This book is continued on Disc 6.